And the series was on Answering Evolution, which is the title here. And this particular session was on what is it that evolution really is. And as I was trying to figure out for that particular session what we were going to talk about, I got a magazine in the mail that I subscribed to called Natural History. And the November 2005 issue was all about what they called the New Darwinism. And the New Darwinism is, what is Darwinism now that it wasn't before? In other words, what is state-of-the-art Darwinism? What are its tenets? What does it hold? And I thought that was perfectly appropriate for that particular session, because we were talking about how do you answer evolution? Since the question is, what is evolution and what do they see themselves to be, this particular magazine became very, very important to me. And the reason was that this particular magazine is the magazine of the American Museum of Natural History. And because of that, and because of the people who author some of the articles in here, this is the state-of-the-art argument set for evolutionists. Yes, go ahead. That's for insurance. Yeah. It's not Answers in Genesis. The folks who put Natural History Museum would never let that get out. Yeah. Good. Yeah, very perceptive. Yeah. This is a detective waiting to happen. Now, as I go through this, one of the things I forgot was my glasses, so I'm going to have to read rather slowly. But yeah, you hear slowly. That's even better. But what I'd like to do is recite to you what their editorial lead-in is, and it's called the Upfront, the New Darwinism. And this is their statement. Evolutionary biology has always been the most controversial of the scientific disciplines. Darwin himself hesitated to bring his ideas to light for fear of the misunderstanding and vitriol they might engender. His fears, of course, were justified. Richard Dawkins, in his introduction to this month's special section on Darwin and evolution, or in his terms, the illusion of design, diagnoses half of the public relations problem. Darwin's revolutionary theory of evolution by natural selection is too simple for its own good. How could something so straightforward explain anything so manifold as the origin of species? The other half of the problem is the subject matter. Evolution treads on issues, the very origins of the human family, that arouse blood passions. Many evolutionary biologists today have been as reticent as Darwin was to wade into the public controversy. First, they will tell you, the controversy of interest to most people, the opposition of religious fundamentalists to Darwinism, lies outside science. We'll get into that in a minute. Second, they will add, debating creationism, now rebranded and repositioned as intelligent design, can only grant scientific legitimacy to a position that has gained none on its own. The late Stephen Jay Gould made the latter argument when this magazine assembled a forum on evolution and its critics nearly 4 years ago. But Gould was anything but reticent about fighting back when it came to testifying in court against teaching creationism in public school science classes. Many evolutionists have at last concluded that Gould's aggressive stance must be extended beyond the courtroom. Too often, though, their counterattacks have been condescending. Remember, this is the vocal group that is speaking for evolution here. This is the evolutionist camp. Trust us, they say, the evidence for evolution is overwhelming. But the reasons science deserves that trust, the positive case for evolution, have stayed far from the public eye. The issue in your hands is intended to fill part of that void. The evidence for evolution is, their emphasis, is overwhelming. And as you will read this issue, you will soon appreciate why. The New Darwinism builds on classic Darwinian ideas, but Its modern vigor derives from evidence that was unavailable or even inconceivable to Darwin himself. Here are the 3 points. Evolution has now been directly observed in nature. For a quick list of examples, you'll see a table on page 50. The fossil evidence in support of evolution is now abundant. The revolution in genetics, utterly undreamt of in Darwin's day, makes an irresistible case for the unity of life on Earth. Now, it's very easy for those of us who've been in this class for a number of years, and maybe even if you haven't been in this class for a number of years, to look at these things and sort of laugh or sneer or have any kind of impression you want to have. But you have to recognize that the purpose of this magazine now, or as it's been for a long time, but in this particular issue, is to point out what they believe to be fact. Okay, this is not something that's refutable. They believe that this is overwhelming evidence, and that anything contrary to this is just a figment of your imagination. Now, supposedly, these things are so well cast that there would be no argument against them, and then they go about giving some particular arguments from some of our most famous evolutionists. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through some of these, because we're not going to have time to go through all of them, and let you see exactly what is supposedly state-of-the-art neo-Darwinian, the new Darwinism, neo-Darwinian theory. Let's look at evolution in action. Go to another page here. Now, this particular article called Evolution in Action is written by a chap named Jonathan Weiner. Now, Jonathan Weiner, around 1994, wrote a book that was titled The Finch's Beak, which got him a prize. What was the prize? It was a writing prize, Pulitzer Prize, for wonderful research, okay, for great journalism. Now, what Jonathan Weiner did was he went down to the Galapagos Islands and studied with a couple of biologists who were studying the finches on the Galapagos Islands and watching them change. Now, as he did this, he had an interesting observation. He spent just a couple of years with them, but they had spent about a decade down there. And what they had seen was that this set of birds with a particular kind of beak were very capable of getting the food. So if they had thick beaks, they were able to break the seeds that required a thick beak to break. Okay, now as that kind of food went away, those birds went away too. Okay, that population shrank. The food that was left was what? The easy food to get. So the birds with the slighter beaks, they had longer beaks that were much smaller and could get into the smaller seeds. What do you think happened to that population? Expanded. Okay, now, they watched this cycle occur several times, and they recorded those observations. Now, what went on after that was what they published, but Jonathan Weiner published as the actual observation of evolution occurring right before their very eyes. Now, here's what Jonathan Weiner writes in this. In this, which is the evolutionist's sort of dogmatic position. For most of the 20th century, the only well-known example of evolution in action was the case of peppered moths in industrial England. The moth had its picture in all the textbooks as a kind of special case. Now, let's stop there for a second. How many folks here are familiar with the peppered moth example? Okay, almost everybody here. The peppered moth example was a really bad one to use, especially in a magazine like this, because everybody knows that it was not a good example, that it actually was rather a hoax. But despite that, this magazine, which you probably find in most doctors' offices, if not most, many, I found it in at least two, and in libraries all over the place, uses that as their standard. We'll keep on going here. In 1973, a married pair of evolutionary biologists, Peter and Rosemary Grant, now at Princeton University, began a study of Darwin's process in Darwin's islands, the Galapagos, watching Darwin's finches. Now, by the way, Darwin never studied these finches. They were called that by somebody else. At first, they assumed that they would have to infer the history of evolution in the islands from the distribution of the various finch species, varieties, and populations across the archipelago. That is pretty much what Darwin had done, in broad strokes, after the Beagle's 5-week survey of the islands in 1835. But the Grants soon discovered that at their main study site, a tiny desert island called Daphne Major, near the center of the archipelago, the finches were evolving rapidly. Conditions on the island swung wildly back and forth from wet years to dry years, and finches on Daphne adapted to each swing from generation to generation. With the help of graduate students, the Grants began to spend a good part of every year on Daphne, watching evolution in action as it shaped and reshaped the finches' beaks. Now let's just stop there for a second and ask ourselves a question. When they say that evolution actually occurred there, are they saying that they observed evolution or that they inferred evolution from these changing populations? They're saying they observed it. We know that they're inferring it, but they're saying that they actually observed it. And that was basically the premise of Jonathan Weiner's book that got him that Pulitzer Prize, was that this is proof. This is proof of evolution occurring right before our eyes. Now, the reason that I bring this up is that this is so commonly said that it shows up in magazines, newspapers, NOVA shows on television, Discovery Channel stuff, all over the place as evidence, incontrovertible evidence, that evolution is occurring right before our eyes. One of the things that 2 years ago when I was at Lake Avenue, I asked the folks who were there, what do you want to see next year? And a huge percentage, about 73% of the people said, we want more stuff on evolution. And I was surprised because I would have thought by now that people would have figured out that it's bunk. But they haven't figured it out. And part of the reason they haven't figured it out is because so much of the propaganda that comes out is in such beautiful terms. Okay, you see it in these wonderful magazines, uttered by people who have great degrees, people who get Pulitzer Prizes, who write best-selling books. But when you actually inspect what it is that they're saying isn't what's really there. It is not observed that evolution occurred. All that is observed, actually, is the change in the populations of the birds. When there's no food, the population diminishes. When the food comes back, they can eat. The population expands. That came and went several times in the cycle that they were there. And when it was all over with, actually what their thesis was that, yes, evolution is occurring right before our very eyes, but guess what? Neither of the species actually changed when the study was over with. Okay, you had the same species at the end that you had at the beginning, yet this is evolution occurring before our very eyes. Yeah. And they're defining species by these beaks. I don't know that. I don't want to get into the definition of species because it's way too complicated, and I'm not qualified for that. So what does the magazine do with this? Well, after Mr. Weiner introduces that statement page there, he goes on to give some examples of this. And here are some of the examples of evolution directly observed. The first one is a marine snail. The shell shape and the thickness have changed in the past century, probably in response to being heavily hunted by crabs, but we don't end up with a different snail. We end up with different thicknesses of the shell. And this is survival of the fittest, according to this article. And the author claims that this is evolution happening before our very eyes. It's one of the examples that they give in this magazine. Now, one of the things that you hear chanted by evolutionists consistently is the survival of the fittest. And it gets uttered so often that it has become sort of a song for them. And what I recommend to people is, you know, when people talk about survival of the fittest, we ought to talk about the arrival of the fittest. Okay, the survival isn't as important as the arrival. How do these creatures get there to begin with? They're so interested in the survival of the fittest that they forget about the arrival of the fittest. How did they get there? And let's ask that question first. We'll agree that the fit survive because people who survive are fit. Okay, that's a circular argument. Who cares? Survival of the fittest argument isn't the thing to ask. question isn't who survives, the question is how did they arrive? Not survival of the fittest, the arrival of the fittest. Another one of these examples of incontrovertible proof that evolution is true is that the evolutionists show us the Anole lizard where the hind limbs change to adapt to their new habitats. Now, mind you, they didn't get more limbs, or they didn't grow wings, or gills, or any of the other things that we would expect evolution to provide to these folks. They do what a lot of animals do. They change physically within the certain particular aspects of their species, which is predefined by already existing genetics. Okay, they've already got these abilities. It's not like evolution endowed them with something new. There's nothing about this that's particularly significant, except that the author, Jonathan Weiner, and the editors of this magazine and all the other people who contributed believe that this is evolution occurring before our eyes. The soapberry bug, kind of the same. You know, that changes a little bit after its habitat's been invaded. My answer to that is, so what? Scarlet honey creeper, its bill length gets changed. The same thing as the previous examples. So what? Go ahead. Well, we could call them that. Well, I think, as a matter of fact, you're right, and I wouldn't argue against you. I think you're absolutely right. But the issue I'm trying to get across here is that these folks actually hold this out to be evolution. Yeah, and that really is the important point, is that there are not really any big changes occurring here. The rabbit is still a rabbit, and in this case here, you have the E. coli. The E. coli bacteria have already in their genes a process by which they will produce new enzymes for nutrient digestion when their present food supply is altered. In other words, they come factory equipped with the ability to do what this supposedly evolutionary thing is doing. There's no new change to their genes, no conversion in the animal or the creature itself. It's what the animal is already programmed to do. And what these do, just a second here, what these do is they prove to us one important thing. First of all, the question, is this directly observed evolution, or is it really evidence that the types don't change? And as I put up here, you have the little arrows between the bunny turning into a bunny and the E. coli turning into E. coli and all of these other things turning into the same things over again. It's important to realize that a huge proportion of the population outside of this room actually thinks that this is evolution. And when they hear people talk about these changes, well, look at the changes in the limbs. Look at the bunny ears changed. Look at the fat content of that particular stickleback changed. That is, to them, evolution. And we have to be able to answer that. Yes, sir. Yeah, they... No, but you know what's interesting is they explicitly say that in this. And for the recording, the question was, aren't they extrapolating microevolution into macroevolution? And the answer is yes, that's exactly what they're doing. And in here, if I had my glasses, I'd find it for you, but they say right up front, that is exactly what they're doing. One of the chief tenets of evolutionary theory is the extrapolation of macroevolution from microevolution. And they say it in those words here. So that being the case, they have to defend that. But this isn't a defense of it. This is what in a court of law would be considered cumulative evidence, except it's not really all that great. It's sort of a defective analogy in some ways, because in court, cumulative evidence, evidence would be declared cumulative by a judge if you keep presenting evidence of the same fact in many, many different ways and the fact isn't being controverted otherwise. In other words, if they were going to try somebody for blowing up the Twin Towers and they were to have people march in and stand there and say, yeah, I stood there and watched the airplane hit the tower. And they march another person, yeah, I saw an airplane hit the tower, over and over and over. That would be cumulative evidence. The same thing being testified to by a number of people beyond the point at which it's any value. Okay, whether 70 people say it or 7,000 people say it, we get it. Okay, and courts are allowed to say, that's cumulative, we're not doing it anymore. In terms of the argument for evolution, if you're going to keep repeating the fact that these transitions occur, you're doing nothing more than accumulating the evidence or creating cumulative case. You're saying the same thing over and over again, and a multitude of the numbers doesn't affect the value of the evidence. You're still making the same presumption that these changes within a species, as John put it, the interspecies changes, are somehow proof or evidence that you can make this macroevolutionary jump. And that macroevolutionary jump that you mentioned is precisely the thing to impugn, because this is not evidence of the jump. It's the presumption that precedes that jump. You're going to say something in the back there? Well, their argument is consistent. I'm not arguing that it's inconsistent. The question is whether the evidence sustains their argument. And so where I'm going with this is, in this narrow focus, is first of all to show what it is that they're saying. And that the claim that evolution is being directly observed isn't evidence of this change from microevolution to macroevolution. Yet when it is uttered in the news media or in magazines, it is pretended to be or held out to be evolution directly observed. So what I want to do is make you understand what the case is that they're presenting and how they're holding it out. Go ahead. Right. The question is, are they playing a word game? And the answer is yes. The answer, you're exactly right. They are playing a word game. And the tough part about it is that as they play this word game, there are several problems in there. And the reason that they're so effective at playing the word game is that in certain domains within scientific disciplines, you can use the term evolution as a term of art. In other words, it can have a very specific definition, a very narrow definition, that the practitioners of that particular science understand and accept. It's a conventional definition. When it's a conventional definition by a particular group, it becomes a term of art and it has a lot of power. And it's very useful to advance that particular practice. Now, the problem becomes not that they have a term of art that they can apply conventionally. The problem is that there are other definitions that they allow to linger and become vague and mix and confuse with this term of art, so that the powerful term then acquires, or the vague terms all acquire the same power and value as the term of art. In other words, they acquire a scientific value or a political value or a rhetorical value that gets linked to this term of art that has actually a practical value in a science. So they play this word game and then change the meaning as they go along without ever telling you that that's what's going on. And that is really important for everybody in this class to appreciate, because the word game is being played all the time, and it's why we have to pin down definitions with great particularity. In the back there, the gentleman says, well, are they saying microevolution is becoming macroevolution, and that's really what they're saying? If they're saying that, and that is what they're saying, we have to pin them down and let them say that. Let that be what gets said. Now, one of the things that was interesting about this E. coli thing was E. coli bacteria reproduce every 20 minutes or so. There are 26,280 generations per year, and in the past 60 years of E. coli research, there have been 1.5 million E. coli generations, and none of them have become anything other than bacteria. And the reason why that's important is because, according to the theory of evolution, if you have many, many generations, you should have some change. Okay, they've done it with Drosophila flies, and here we have E. coli, and you still have, 60 million generations, you still have the same thing. They're not turning into flies or lizards or anything else, which, of course, I'm being crazy when I say that, but the changes that they could have had should have occurred and haven't. And just that E. coli, it's a really bad example for them because that's the one that has the fastest change. Now let's move into something else about the fossil evidence. Yeah. Right. And then my response to that would be, and could you please turn the light, when this side of the light's on, I cannot see what I'm reading here. It's bad enough that I don't have my glasses, but that I can't see what I'm reading is even worse. The answer to that would be that you can't claim that evolution is true if when you've been given 60 million generations, you haven't seen a change. Okay? One of the things that gets said a lot, And it was actually said in the Dover versus Pennsylvania case by the judge who quoted one of the philosophers of science and one of the scientists. They said, well, the absence of evidence isn't the evidence of absence. Well, the only problem with that is that's false. That is false. And the judge fell for that hook, line, and sinker. Here's what you do to prove that that's false. If I say there is a giant blue turtle standing on each one of your heads, and I tell you, and you say, well, no, there isn't, and I say, yeah, there is, and you say, no, there isn't. We go back and forth, and I ask, well, can you prove it? There's no turtle on your head. On everybody's head here, there's a giant blue turtle. And you say, well, I don't see it, I don't feel it, I don't touch it. Well, gee, that's just the absence of evidence. That's not evidence of absence. Okay? There is evidence of absence when there's no evidence there. All right? You've got to have some evidence. If you don't have the evidence, you can say, I have some reason to believe that it's not there. Okay? Now, is it incontrovertible evidence? No. It is evidence, though. Again, it's a part of the word game that gets played here. It would be proper to say that the absence of evidence is not incontrovertible proof that the evidence is absent. Okay? That would be correct. But to say there's no evidence of absence because there's no evidence at all is wrong. Is wrong. You can prove a negative, or at least give evidence for a negative, by showing it's not there. Okay, the blue turtle on top of your head. The fact that there's no evidence for it being there is evidence that it is not there. Go ahead. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the extra universes that we don't know are there. We're just gambling that it's there, and we have no evidence for it, but let's believe it anyway. That's right. Okay, let's go about looking at the question of the fossil evidence, which they hinge a big portion of their case on. A lot of the evidence in this magazine talks about the fossil evidence. Creationists long touted the absence of transformational fossils for whales as evidence against evolution. The balance has now changed. In 1983, specimens of Paleocetus were discovered in Pakistan, Pakistan, and early Eocene back beds 53 million years ago, although the study of the body of the Pakicetus was primarily terrestrial, it had the skull and teeth of the ancient Archaeocetes, the earliest family of whales. Then in 1994, the Ambulocetus natans, literally the walking whale that swims, was discovered in Pakistan. The animal was the size of a large sea lion with broad webbed feet on both toes, both fore and hind limbs, and so it could both walk and swim. Yet it still had tiny hoofs on its toes and the primitive skull and teeth of the Archaeocene. Let's go into this here. Alright, now this nice looking creature here. Now which one's the Archaeocene? The one that's getting munched or the guy who's doing the eating there? Okay. The Ambulocetus natans is the guy at the bottom who's jumping out of the water, and he's going to have this other ancient guy for breakfast. Now it's, well, who knows what it is? I mean, it's something that has all of these different features on it. You know, it looks like something that was created by committee, and yet it's considered to be one of the creatures that's intermediary. Because it has teeth that supposedly resemble those of early whales and has what are presumed to be tiny hoofs on his toes, which supposedly resemble terrestrial animals, this is considered an intermediary species. Some evolution theorists believe that it may have used up and down motion of the spine to help it swim, which they also believe was the precursor to the motion of the flukes of the whale's tail. Now, mind you, there's no evidence of this, but this is put into the magazine and the books to say that, well, this is the way we think it worked. Very complete. Yeah, they have a complete skeleton. Yeah. The major problem is that there is no whale fluke nor any other swimming implements of a whale on this creature. Further, the skull of a whale has a unique fluid system for, among other things, echolocation, unlike any other creature on Earth, and there are no intermediates possessing anything like that. Only the fully formed whales have bone structures like that in their heads. Teeth that look like whales' teeth are not evidence of whale evolution. It just means that whatever the whales use their teeth for, this guy used his teeth for too. Now, that doesn't mean that the other whales jumped out of the water and munched on these guys, although there are some whales today that can do that. Like killer whales will do the same thing. They'll go out and get the sea lions out right on the shoreline. Now, this is a set, starting at the bottom, working your way up, of conceptual precursors that evolutionary theorists claim are physical precursors. The distinction there is very important when you talk to people who are interested in evolution. And that is that merely because you can conceive of a transitional set of phases like this doesn't mean that they are physically related. And that's what you have to bring across. These great pictures and diagrams that are full of these so-called intermediary species are just concepts. There is no evidence for them. There's no evidence for the links between these guys. Yes? Well, the scale is maybe backwards here. The top is the present and the bottom is 60 million years ago. The whale, you know, the fact that evolutionists used a whale as a feature of evolution is the most bizarre thing I've seen, because it's so hard to get there. I mean, you can have creatures on land that are going to be, you know, lose their feet and lose their ability to do their land things, and then somehow they're going to grow these fins, which they say just shrank, and then they go in the water. They swim around a lot. The ones who swim around best tend to live. So tiny little evolutionary changes mean they're going to get better at swimming. They gain these flaps, which turn into fins. Then they gain all of the stuff in their head that makes them get echolocation. La da 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 da. Yeah, that is a fantastic myth. It's a fabulous myth because there is no evidence for it. And so what you have for evidence are these fossils that occur at different times in the fossil record. And because the old ones died off and another version shows up or another creature shows up that has some of the features of the other one, they believe that that necessarily shows that one turned into the other, but we just can't find the fossils that were in between them. And that's a big problem, because evolution is occurring only where you can't find it. Yes? The question about increasing genetic information and where does it come from, that's part of the new Darwinism, is that you don't need an increase in genetic information, that the genetic information in bacteria is sufficient to produce this. Yeah. The big thing now is Hox genes. And I'll get into that if I have time, because they talk about Hox genes in this issue of Natural History. Now this one is one of my favorites, and I'm glad they put it in here, because this is one of the things that evolutionists actually believe and thrust at the populace as proof of evolution. And this is so incredibly wacky that I don't know how they can do it without blushing. You know what? I'm going to have you read this, because I just cannot see it. From here... down to where that little is.
Yep.
Here, go here.
What's that?
Among the most remarkable transformations that took place as the mammals emerged are the ones that can be observed in fossils of the lower jaws. In reptiles and primitive synapsids, the right and left lower jaws are each made up of a number of bones, one of which is the dentary or tooth-bearing bone. As synapsids evolved, the dentary bone grew progressively larger until it took over the role of hinging the jaw to the skull. One of the other reptilian jaw bones shrank until it vanished, whereas the other two shifted to the middle ear. There they became the anvil and the hammer, minute bones that transmit sound from the eardrum to the stirrup bone and ultimately to the inner ear.
Thank you. Sounds like a cartoon.
It does. Now this is not held out as a theory. It's held out as actually the way it occurred. Okay, now they'll say, well, we're sure this is the way it happened because it couldn't have happened any other way. Obviously, that's how this happened. Now, the problem here, and the reason that we need to pay attention to how they word this, you heard them talk about this, and you heard them recite the language right out of the book, is that this evolution from a jawbone into the bones of the inner ear is recited as a true story, and it's recited as these conceptual precursors leading up to the current ear bone. Okay? Now I have here some of the things, the bones inside the ear, the malleus, the incus, the stapes, right there next to the eardrum. Now no definition is ever given as to how these changes occurred, how the jawbone changes and turns into these beautifully minute and perfectly functioning systems. But as it is for all of the evolutionary changes, when you actually examine what these things that are supposed to have changed do, and you realize that in order to do this, you don't just change bones. You have to change a whole lot of stuff. The enormous number of corollary changes that have to occur simultaneously is what you emphasize to someone who says, well, you know, they're reading the book that the jawbone turned into an ear bone. You have to say, well, hold on a second. First of all, we're going to say it's going to take 60 million generations or however many generations. I don't even care, Mr. Evolutionist. But the question I pose to you is, how, if this bone is going to change, are you going to get all of the other changes required to make that work? Okay, let's just say that the bone shrank. Okay, the jawbone shrinks, turns into an ear bone. Now, you don't have an ear bone if the jawbone shrinks. Why? Because you don't have an ear because you have a shrunken jawbone. Right? Okay, shrink your jawbone or take a jawbone somewhere and shrink it. Okay, it doesn't turn into an ear. What do you have to have to have an ear? Well, you look at that diagram up there. You've got to have a whole bunch of stuff there. You've got to have these vestibular nerves. You've got to have the bone structure around it. You've got these semicircular canals that do what? Perform a function to keep your balance. It's all part of this. Yes, sir. Well, that's kind of an interesting question, too, but the evolutionists will have an answer for that, which is, we're not sure yet. We need to find more fossils. Okay, the evidence of absence is not absence of evidence? Come on. If we're to believe that the bones that once functioned only for eating, which is what they're saying these bones came from, evolved and later became ear bones needed for hearing, then we also need to have explained all the associated changes that have had to be made at the same time in order for these evolved bones to function as ear parts. This need for simultaneous changes among all associated parts is extremely important to mention when talking about evolution with those who point to similarities in fossils, because they're pointing to just one part of the whole structure. You've got a huge multitude of things occurring at the same time. You need to change more than just a little bit of bone here and a little bit of bone there to create a hearing system. Now, what are some of the things, just in your own mind, that you can come up with that you need to have in order to make this work? I mean, I'll give you some examples and you can keep fleshing it out. But do you not need to have a circulatory system in there in order to keep all of the cells functioning? Okay, so the circulatory system has to evolve commensurate with this. How about a neural system, the brain housing group, okay? And the nerves that go with it. What about the rest of the skeletal system that goes along with that? What else? Got to have a hole inside your head in order to get the air in there to make the hearing occur. Yes. Well, that's an interesting question too. What you're doing is you're citing a lot of the problems that you need to cite when people show you these diagrams and make these wild statements like these jaw bones evolved over time and became the ear. This, by the way, is an explanation for ears, okay, for the hearing system, is that the jaw bones got smaller and smaller and smaller and eventually became these. I don't know how you get there from here, but what you have to realize is what we do when we answer that is to bring up all of the corollary problems that go along with that. You may have given me a conceptual scheme by which a jawbone can become an ear bone, but what you've really done is given me a conceptual scheme by which a jawbone shrinks, and that's all you have given me. You have not explained the presence of an ear bone or any of the other ear bones or the complex of things that goes along with them. I'm running out of time, so I can't answer all the questions right yet. Now, earlier the question was asked, what about genetics? And how do we explain the increased complexity of the genes in the newer creatures that weren't there in the older creatures? Well, their argument is, and the argument of one of the authors, is that particular genes, and they call them the HOX, H-O-X genes, determine the form, number, and evolution of repeating parts. However, the HOX genes don't control the multitude of other anatomical systems that have to occur. And what you see here, you see some purple dye on the chicken embryo on the left, and then the garter snake on the right, the purple dye for the similar vertebrae. And according to the author, the HOX gene would determine how many of those vertebrae are going to be produced. Okay? Now, What would you do if you had a chicken, or let me ask you this, what would a chicken do if one of the HOX genes decided, instead of having 7 of those little vertebrae in the back, decided it was going to have 9 or 13, or in the case of the garter snake, 300? All right, now if the HOX gene makes that kind of change, what have you done? You've merely multiplied the number of vertebrae. Have you changed that to anything other than a twisted, mangled chicken? No, you have not. What you have here is the evolutionists grasping at a concept, which is that these recently discovered HOX genes can control the number of times something will repeat and will determine how big those things are. And that is supposedly an answer for the difference between an embryo of one type that has, say, a few vertebrae and another embryo that has many vertebrae. Well, look. Sure, we couldn't figure out how the snake gets on 300 vertebrae and the chicken has the 7 right in the middle there, but now we can. The HOX gene does it, and the HOX gene's been around for a long, long time. So, according to them, this genetic idea that we can get big things from little things, we don't need any more information. All we need to do is twist that HOX gene a little bit, and instead of having 7 vertebrae, you can have 300. But again, the question to ask them is, what do you get when you just twist the number of something, or even its shape? Are you going to get anything more than a monster? All you're going to get is a monster. Go ahead.
Well,
So make it fast. Okay. I agree. There is a lot of measurement to be done. And what I'm not trying to do here is pose the positive argument for the testable creation model. What I'm trying to do here is expose what it is that the evolutionists are saying in popular media. And you're absolutely right, but that isn't my point here. My point here is to show that when the evolutionists in the popular media are making wild claims of evolution being a fact, which is what they will do, they will actually say that. And there is something in here by Richard Dawkins that, if I can find it, I'd love to read to you before we close, because it gives you the full force of the arrogance of that argument. Now, this evolution of the eyes is another, it's in the same journal, and it's done exactly the same way. It's that you have this brain photo clock in the upper right of your diagram up there, which supposedly turned into the vertebrate camera eye. Now, a brain photo clock is nothing but a cluster of cells in the brain of certain very small animals that lets them know when the sun's up and when the sun's down, okay, so they can alter their circadian rhythms. It also allows them, some of the animals, to determine when the moon is in full phase or not full phase, because that alters their monthly rhythms. From this brain photo clock supposedly generate the vertebrate camera eye, which is immensely, immensely more complex. The two-celled prototype eye supposedly could come from the brain photo clock, which can give rise to the arthropod compound eye, the squid camera eye, or the vertebrate camera eye. Again, these are diagrams of what? Conceptual precursors. And remember that word, because that phrase, it actually works very well when you talk to people. So, look, I see what you're saying here. I like this idea of these conceptual precursors, but where is the evidence that it actually occurred? The question isn't, could it have happened, in concept? The question is, did it happen, and where's the evidence? So these things get put up there, put in these magazines and the books, etc., as evidence. The diagrams are evidence. Well, in court, they wouldn't be evidence. They'd be called demonstrative. In other words, they refer to something else. They demonstrate what somebody is trying to propose as evidence. But this isn't evidence. This is evidence of nothing but their theory or their belief in these kinds of changes without having any kind of idea how it happened. Now, we're out of time, and so I'm going to flip through this, but if we had some more time, what I would ask you to do is take a peek at the idea that the eye is exactly as simple as they claim it is. Okay? Now, this isn't even a good diagram. If you get a doctor's diagram out of a Gray's Anatomy or something like that, it's got more words on it than you can ever put up here and read. The point is that to go from a couple of cells in the brain of a very, very small animal that detects light to this immensely complex feature of the eye, you have to do exactly what we talked about in all of the other cases. We have to say, how do all of these anatomical structures at the same time grow into this magnificent thing that we call the eye? You have to have what? You have to have changes in the brain, changes in the nervous system, changes in the circulatory system, changes in the muscular system. You have to have muscles to drive the eye, changes in the skeletal system in order to make that eye fit. All of that has to occur at exactly the same time. And if it doesn't occur at the same time, you've got nothing but a massive glob of stuff that's doing nothing and serves no end at all. The people who say, well, yeah, the eye sure looks like it's well-designed, but it isn't well-designed. That's an illusion of design. Well, let's say, okay, give me that it is an illusion of design. All right, we were not going to say that God designed it. We're going to let you, Mr. Evolutionist, tell us how you're going to get this all at the same time occurring throughout this organism's history. No evidence of it at all. None at all. And again, I keep repeating this, but what I want to thrust into your mind is that you need to hand back to the evolutionist the paucity of his evidence. Is that, look, you don't go from brain photo clock to all of this magnificence and all of the corollary combined coordinated features just by accident. And there's nothing in the Hox gene that's going to give you a repetition of anything that's going to produce this, nor any series of Hox genes. There is no answer for that. Now, if I can give you just this one last comment that this guy wrote here, you'll really grasp what he's saying about evolution being a fact. It is so incredible. It's Richard Dawkins, who writes Darwin and Evolution. He's a guest of this particular magazine all the time. And he says, the illusion of design is so successful that to this day, most Americans, including significantly many influential and rich Americans, stubbornly refuse to believe it is an illusion. To such people, if a heart or an eye or a bacterial flagellum looks designed, that's proof enough that it's designed. And he goes on to poo-poo that. So that's ridiculous. It just looks designed. Now he goes through his article, gives all sorts of reasons why he thinks that people who believe in design are fools. And then at the end he says, evolution is as much a fact as the heat of the sun. It is not a theory. And for pity's sake, let's stop confusing the philosophically naive by calling it so. Evolution is a fact. Now, until you've read this magazine through and through, and you've read it for maybe a couple of years like I have, you don't really get the flavor of the arrogance of the people who believe this. It comes through continually. Even the ones who are being respectful, and he's being respectful. In other venues, he's actually said that anybody who would believe in Jesus Christ is stupid. Okay? That the whole idea of miracles is foolish, and only people who would follow that are fools. Yes? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Pardon me? Yeah, they poo-poo the other side by making claims like it's not scientific, that the question of science and religion are two different things. And once you've done that, you've automatically demeaned them and changed the argument a priori. We can no longer use evidence to prove our case. That's what the whole idea is, and that's exactly the opposite of what Reason to Believe holds. Reason to Believe holds that let's look at the evidence and not call either one science or religion. Let's just say, here are the facts. We got these two models. Compare the fit. Which one fits better? And according to the Reason to Believe model, the biblical model of creation fits the facts, the predictions, far better than evolution does. So we're at the end of the hour now. What I wanted to present to you was this very, very quick survey of a magazine that's representative of the evolutionist dogma, and that it's out there. This is what your children read in their high school texts, is what they read in college, except for you homeschoolers who are smarter than that and give them other stuff. But in the popular schools, my sons, I've looked in their books, same stuff over and over and over. In order for us to answer it, we have to be able to give them something else. The testable creation model is one thing, but asking the evolutionists to step up and explain these other things is their job, and it's our job, and it's our way of answering them. On that, let me close this in prayer, and we'll be dismissed. Lord, thank you very much for giving us the time to be together, and for letting us see how the other side thinks. May we not see them as our enemy, but as our mission field. To pray for them, to lead them to Christ, and for us to be humble also, Lord, because there are many things we do not know, and many things we think we know that we are wrong about. And may we approach you to find out the truth, and keep our eyes and ears open for other people who need to hear it as well. Bless you in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you very much.